Good morning, it's 7:08, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter. Martial arts teacher and movie star Bruce Lee died 45 years ago on July 20th, 1973, at the age of 32, 1 month before the release of his signature film, Enter the Dragon, released on August 19th, 1973. This pop culture icon defied Asian stereotypes, broke barriers, and bridged the cultures of the East and the West. For the hour, we speak with journalist Matthew Polly, author of Bruce Lee, A Life. He is also a fellow at Yale University and teaches a course on Bruce Lee. So Matthew Polly, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It's wonderful to be on. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about Bruce's early years growing up in Hong Kong and as a child actor, being the product of a father who was also an actor. He starred in at least three movies as a young child and an adolescent.
That's right. One of the things people don't realize is that Bruce was a child actor. Oftentimes I'll read articles where they say Bruce is so famous, but he only appeared in four movies. And they're thinking of the four kung fu movies he made at the end of his life. He actually appeared in nearly 20 Cantonese films as a child actor. He was the Macaulay Culkin of Hong Kong. He played scrappy orphans in movies. He was kind of a pugnacious type. And so his father got him into acting when he was 6 years old. I mean, his very first appearance was a cameo as a two-month-old in a film, but his career started in earnest as a six-year-old, and he continued to play sort of orphan street urchin roles, but even branched out and he did a few comedies and more some serious melodramas. So he had a very wide career as a child actor. Interestingly, none of those movies were kung fu films. He never played an action star until he was an adult.
And what was the gap between his childhood movies and adult movies?
The gap was that he moved to America. As a teenager, he got into a lot of trouble. His favorite activity was street fighting. And one day when he was 18, he picked a fight with a kid whose parents complained to the police, and the police already had him on their radar. So they went to his mother and said, if he doesn't stop this, we're going to throw him in jail. And since Bruce was born in America, he was born in San Francisco, he had a passport. He was an American citizen. And so his parents thought he should use his birthright citizenship to get out of the country and change his life. And when he got to America, he looked around at the Hollywood movies and, in his own words, said the only parts they were letting Chinese play were what he called hop-along Wong roles or pigtailed coolie roles. And he, since he'd been a child actor and a star, wasn't willing to do that kind of demeaning work. So he gave up the idea of acting and decided he would become a kung fu instructor and launch franchises across America. And it was only during a kung fu demonstration at a karate tournament that a Hollywood producer noticed him and offered him a job. And that's how he, almost a fluke of luck, got back into acting as a career.
And how did he originally learn kung fu?
Well, as I mentioned, Bruce was a street fighter. That's what he liked to do. He and a gang of friends, followers of his, would go out and pick fights. And one day he met an older boy who was a better fighter than him. And Bruce was extremely competitive. He hated for anyone to be better at something that he loved to do. And he found out that this boy, William Chung, was better than he was because he studied the martial art of Wing Chun. And so Bruce decided, I'm going to get close to him, join his school, learn all his techniques, and then one day I'll be better than him as a fighter. And so he didn't study martial arts for self-defense reasons. He actually studied them for self-offense reasons.
And he was very critical of traditional kung fu techniques and upset many traditionalists and founded his own styles. How were his styles different than traditional styles like kung fu?
So when he came to America, he was a traditional Wing Chun stylist. But what happened is he was the first Chinese martial artist to ever teach other Americans on a wide basis. His first student was an African American. So he had white, brown, yellow. He had all the colors of the rainbow in his classes. And so all of his students were also kind of street tough kids from Seattle. And many of them were amateur boxers and also practiced judo. And so through sparring with them, he started to pick up techniques that they had learned from different styles. And he realized through that process that what he was doing was not the best. To create the best possible style, you had to mix and match different techniques from different styles. And so he ended up creating a style he called Jeet Kune Do, which meant the way of the intercepting fist. And he based that on a combination of kung fu, Western boxing, and also Western fencing, which was a unique addition. His older brother, Peter, had been a star high school fencer, and Bruce became sort of fell in love with the theory of fencing and read thousands of books on it and became quite good at fencing himself. And so he combined his style, and he thought of it as sort of unarmed fencing.
And you mentioned a little earlier about his first student being an African-American, and this is Jesse Glover.
Yes.
Who you mentioned in your book, he put the final dirt in
Bruce's grave. When everyone had left, the workers came to fill the grave as is custom. And he stuck around, and he said the reason he did it was because it didn't feel right that Bruce would be covered by strange hands.
In addition to Jesse Glover, he also taught Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. What do you think drove his philosophy on inclusivity with martial arts in teaching everyone?
I think it was because he was discriminated himself, but not just because he was an Asian in America, but also because he was a Eurasian in Hong Kong. Many people don't realize this, but Bruce Lee's ancestry was mixed. His great-grandfather was Dutch Jewish, and his maternal grandmother was 100% English. So Bruce was not full Chinese. And in Hong Kong at that time, there was discrimination by the Chinese against Eurasians for being mixed. And so he was almost kicked out of his Wing Chun school by jealous students who complained that Kung Fu shouldn't be taught to not anyone who is not full-blooded Chinese. And so I think that experience shaped his progressive attitudes towards race. I mean, he was really a kind of post-racial figure. Whenever he was asked, do you think of yourself as Chinese or American? He would say, I think of myself as a human being, because under heaven, we're all of one family. And so in many ways, he was far ahead of his time. In fact, he's probably ahead of our time, too.
And later in his life, in movies like The Chinese Connection, we kind of got a glimpse of what it was like. But can you walk us through the atmosphere of the Japanese occupation in China that Bruce Lee grew up in? I mean, even being a Eurasian, but just what it was like for Chinese people at that time in Hong Kong during the Japanese occupation.
That's right. So Bruce was born in 1940 in San Francisco, and then his parents returned when he was old enough to travel about 5 months to Hong Kong. And very soon after that, the Japanese invaded Hong Kong and occupied it. And it was a brutal, vicious occupation. A third of the population fled, a third of the population was killed, and a third nearly starved to death. Bruce's father was one of the lucky ones because he was an opera actor, and the Japanese occupation force felt keeping opera going was good for their self-image. And so his family had a slightly better food ration than everyone else. But it created a great deal of anger and resentment, obviously, because millions of Hong Kong Chinese were killed during the occupation. And so when Bruce made his later movies, particularly The Chinese Connection, you can see that anti-Japanese fervor that always was under the surface there come out in full force. I mean, the movie is very much a anti-Japanese World War II response to what had happened to them. And so Bruce was recreating it and showing a heroic Chinese side. And that's why he became such a big star, because they were reimagining a past where they had been humiliated as one where they had some heroic moments.
And he also took some Japanese digs in Fist of Fury as well.
Yes, that's right. So the Chinese and the Japanese have a long sibling rivalry that gets bloody every few centuries. And one of the digs that the Chinese have is that all of Japanese culture came from China. So they believe that karate was derived from kung fu, and Zen Buddhism came from China. And so they look on Japan like this little brother who got uppity and caused them trouble. And so the movies have these little digs towards the Chinese. when they're not overt, they're still there.
And can you talk a little bit about the Chinese versus Japanese fighting styles? Like you mentioned karate being Japanese and styles like kung fu being Chinese.
Yes. So this was one of Bruce Lee's things when he first came over. He would compare the two and he would argue that karate was stiff and rigid and kung fu was more fluid. It was more like water. He compared a karate strike to an iron bar that hits you. And a kung fu strike to a whip that wraps around and at the last moment has its full force. And so that was one of the many things. But I studied kung fu in China at the Shaolin Temple, and that prejudice is still there today. They still like to talk about how inferior karate is to their style.
And what's the Japanese interpretation?
Well, the Japanese, of course, think their style is better. As everyone does.
Of course.
Or you wouldn't study it if you didn't think yours was superior. And, you know, I think they admit that it originally came from China, but they improved it and made it better. And so, you know, I think their take on it is the same way they felt about automobiles in the 1970s. We didn't invent it, but we perfected it.
And after leaving Hong Kong as an adolescent, he headed back to the States and the Bay Area in particular. And you mentioned before, many people may not have known that he was born in San Francisco and opened up a martial arts school in Oakland. And at that time, your book mentions also that the Bay was known as the Kung Fu epicenter. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. San Francisco's Chinatown was the largest Chinatown in the world. It had more Chinese than any place outside of Asia. San Francisco Chinatown Chinese had been there since the 1850s when gold was discovered in California and Chinese workers were recruited because white employers felt that they could pay them less and they were less likely to strike or cause trouble. And so over the years, there were many laws, anti-Chinese laws passed, particularly the Exclusion Act of 1882 that banned all Chinese workers from entering the United States. It was the first time any ethnic group had been banned only because of their country of origin. And so they sort of gathered in Chinatown and became a bit introverted and isolated and didn't interact with the white community because they viewed it as hostile, which it was. And so they taught kung fu as a self-defense technique to young men inside the community and didn't generally teach it to anyone who was not Chinese. And it wasn't until the 1960s that you started to see a very tiny few Chinese schools in San Francisco have one or maybe two Caucasian students. And it was really Bruce Lee who broke open kung fu and popularized it with the West and in America, because the vast majority of Americans had no idea what kung fu was.
And can you talk a little bit more about Bruce Lee's Bay Area connections?
Well, he was born there. His name means to excite San Francisco. His Chinese name is Li Junfan, and Fan is the character for San Francisco in Chinese. So even his name is connected to the city. When he came back, he stayed the summer in San Francisco before moving to Seattle because his father had a friend in Seattle who was willing to put Bruce up. And so Bruce went to school at the University of Washington and lived in Seattle for 3 or 4 years. After he opened a school in Seattle, he wanted to open a second branch. And San Francisco in the Bay Area was the epicenter of Kung Fu. And so he opened a school in Oakland and lived there for about 18 months to 2 years. Before he moved to Los Angeles when his career as an actor took off.
And so with his move to LA and becoming more of an actor there, you mentioned in your book how he's passed over by white actors in what we might call yellowface. One example that comes to mind to me is David Carradine in the TV series Kung Fu.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is one of the we don't think about it as much now, but in the 50s and 60s, there were a series of movies about Fu Manchu and Charlie Chan, the two sort of archetypal Chinese characters in Western cinema. And both of those characters were played by white actors in yellowface, where they would slant the eyes with tape and put on some makeup. In fact, Charlie Chan was played by a Swedish actor. And there were very good Asian actors in Hollywood at the time, but they just weren't cast in the roles because no one wanted to cast an Asian in the part. And so that's the first reason Bruce thought, you know, I'm never going to go to Hollywood, because even if I get a small part, I can never get a leading role because those parts all go to white actors. And it continued to be a problem for him throughout his career in Hollywood. And Kung Fu is the best example. It's a story about a Eurasian Kung Fu master. And Bruce Lee was the only Eurasian Kung Fu actor in all of Hollywood. And he still wasn't cast in that part. They gave it to David Carradine, who was a drug addict and knew nothing about Kung Fu. But still, the executives preferred David Carradine to Bruce Lee.
But eventually, he did land the role of Kato in the television series of The Green Hornet. Can you talk about the significance of that role of Kato?
Well, it's important. A lot of people forget he was initially offered the leading role in a TV series called Charlie Chan's Number One Son. And that's why he was so excited, because he thought he was going to be the first Chinese-American to ever star, American male actor to ever star in a TV series. But that was canceled because executives, TV executives, didn't believe the American audience would accept a Chinese leading actor in a TV series. And so he got bumped down to Kato, the sidekick to the Green Hornet, in which he plays a houseboy. He wasn't happy at all about this, but the producer assured him that they would beef up the role and let him be sort of the weapon of Kato and show off his kung fu. And that was the first opportunity an American audience ever had to watch kung fu on TV. And so in that sense, it was a step forward, not as big a one as Bruce had originally hoped, but it still allowed him to launch his career. Bruce ended up, as playing Kato, getting more fan mail than the star. Playing Kato got him in the door of Hollywood. And, you know, it was almost random that it happened.
And what was the significance of Kato to his career in general?
Well, he never would have tried to be an actor in America if he hadn't landed the part of Kato. And once he had, then he had some credibility in the industry. And it also made him famous in America's very small martial arts community of the time. And so he was invited to a lot of karate tournaments where he would be the guest star. He got to meet many of the most famous karate champions of the time, including Chuck Norris, who became one of his students and a very close friend. And through Kato, he was able to launch a career as a celebrity kung fu instructor. When he had trouble after The Green Hornet was canceled, he had trouble finding parts because there were so few parts for Asian actors. And in order to support himself, his wife, and his young son, he started teaching celebrities. So he was friends and the teacher of Steve McQueen and James Coburn. And that really helped him advance his movie career, because while he was with them, he was able to study what it takes to be a star, what you need fashion-wise, attitude, connections. And so in a weird way, by being the kung fu instructor to a bunch of celebrities, that was like his time learning how to become a celebrity himself.
But he went back to Hong Kong after this to then make Fist of Fury, The Chinese Connection, and Return of the Dragon because of his disappointment with the roles in the U.S.
That's right. What happened was, for about 4 years after The Green Hornet was canceled, he couldn't get decent parts. About once a year, he would get a walk-on role on some second-rate TV show, and that wasn't enough to support him. And he decided he would try to launch his own movie project, which he called The Silent Flute, and he got James Coburn to agree to be part of it, and he got Sterling Siliphant, who was the Academy Award-winning screenwriter, to write the script. And Warner Brothers was going to back it, but only if they filmed it in India. And they couldn't find a good location, so James Coburn backed out. And that really broke Bruce's heart, that project failed. And so he was desperate for money. He had just bought a house in Bel Air that was more than he could afford. And his wife had a second child. They had a second child together, a daughter named Shannon. And so he needed the money. And in Hong Kong, interestingly enough, they had released The Green Hornet, unbeknownst to Bruce, and they renamed it The Kato Show. And so Bruce became famous in Hong Kong again as the Hong Kong guy who went to Hollywood and in their eyes had made it, even though he himself was struggling. And so a bunch of movie producers offered him roles, and he needed the money. So he went back to Hong Kong and signed a 2-movie deal. And those movies made him the most famous Hong Kong actor in the world.
And after the successes of those films, well, he caught America's attention in terms of the martial arts involved in those films.
Right? That's right. So there's a joke in Hollywood that the only color Hollywood sees is green. And what they saw was he had made these 3 movies in Hong Kong for budgets that were less than $100,000. So less than it would cost to make a 30-second commercial on TV. And yet they'd made millions of dollars. And that's what inspired Warner Brothers to come up with a script and offer him the first starring role for a Chinese-American actor in a Hollywood movie, in the movie Enter the Dragon. And it was only because he was so successful with his Hong Kong movies that he finally got a chance to star in a Hollywood movie.
That was journalist Matthew Polly, author of the new book, Bruce Lee, A Life, speaking about the iconic star of American popular culture on the 45th anniversary of his death. And up next, we'll continue our conversation on Bruce Lee with Matthew Polly. We'll also include a brief but soulful tribute produced by author Zoe Williams to the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, who died yesterday, August 16th, at the age of 76. That's all next, after the news.